So I've been asked to talk about Buddhism and faith today. I think faith is something that often we don't really like to talk about in Buddhism. It's almost like it's understated, especially in our modern, contemporary Sydney Western society. And I've just guessed at a few reasons why we may have some misconceptions about faith. So tell me, have you come across images like this? Or like this? They don't seem very peaceful. There's no inner peace, is there? Or like this? Or like this? That just looks like a monastery on fire or something, to be honest. But this image, that's a common image. I grew up with this, you know. Yeah, you too? I used to think this was Buddhism, right? So what is this? This is an image of people going to the monasteries, particularly on Chinese New Year Day. And I was taught when I was very young, you have to be the first one to put the incense at the front, and then you have, like, lots of prosperity that year, okay? So people, you'll see them, like, nudging everyone, trying to be there, and they'll all be waiting there at 11:59, midnight, waiting to be the first one to stick it on there. And I remember reading a newspaper article that told me that there was this monastery in China, and everyone was waiting, right? 11:50, everyone was waiting to be the first one to put the incense on. And who actually put it on first? It was the keeper of the temple. Came from underneath the table and just chucked it on there, and everyone was so disappointed. Yeah, and that made headlines. And I used to think, because at my home we have like a small shrine, right? Nothing fancy, but just a small shrine. And it's got all the utensils, you know, you've got the incense, you've got the bowl where people put the incense. And I used to say to Mum, we don't really need to go over there because we can do it at home and there'll be no crowds. And we will definitely, definitely be the first one. I said to her, I won't fight with you, you can be the first one to put it on there, right? But there's something about, like, you know, no, you have to go there, you know, you have to show, this is what I was told, you have to show the angels, the devas, whatever you want to call them, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, that you're sincere, that you have faith, right? In Chinese we call it Seng Sam, right? So you have faith that you've travelled all this way, you've stood there with all the crowd, and you've managed to be the first one to put the incense on. That shows your faith. And because of that, you have lots of karma and you have a great year that year. Okay? Can I tell you, when I used to do this, I used to go inside and the smoke from the incense was incredible. And I would come out with, like, tears in my eyes. And, you know, being me, I would say to my mum, Mum, I'm starting the new year crying. This is horrible. Okay? But none of that really appealed to me. You know, there was something about it that just didn't make much sense to me. And I think I started from that perspective, and then there's other stuff as well which I won't go into, but lots and lots of these rituals and superstition and all of that. And then it gets to a point where I come to university, right? And university, I'm very rational, very logical, hence why I chose law. And that to me was illogical, right? Faith to me was illogical. Faith to me didn't make sense. So then I started looking it up on the internet. And you see things like this. Right? You ever come across these quotes? Believe nothing, no matter where you read it or who said it, no matter if I have said it, unless it agrees with your own reason and common sense. Put up your hand if you've read something along those lines. Yeah. It's one of those, these ones are different images of the same thing. And they're the type of stuff that people would forward on. You know, if you've got Facebook, it's like, share. Okay, it's that kind of stuff. And when I first came across it, I thought, oh, Buddhism's great. And actually, some people have said to me they love Buddhism for this precise reason, because it's different from all the other religions. You don't have to believe in anything. You know, you don't have to believe. You don't have to have faith. All you need is common sense. And to me, I thought, great, because I like common sense. I like logic. I like rationality. Because common sense is personal, isn't it? Okay? It's me. It is. It's about me. So this is a quote that often people like to throw up, and they say, this is why there is no faith in Buddhism, or something along those lines. But what about this? I know you won't believe it, but that quote is fake. It's not real. It's people putting words in the Buddha's mouth. He said something along those lines, but not exactly what you just read about common sense and rationality. And I just put a website up there, which is fakebuddhaquotes.com. Please check it out. It is awesome, okay? And it actually teaches a lot of stuff, because it teaches you all the things that you find on the internet that people are quoting, and misquoting of what the Buddha said. But they also give a good explanation as to why it came about, and also an explanation as to what the true meaning should be. Right? So it's actually very informative, but in a funny kind of way. And why does that happen? Because in modern society, you know, people don't like to read slabs and slabs of writing. Yeah, we've got quite a short attention span, ADD kind of society, right? We just like short quotes, snappy kind of stuff. Stuff that you can read in a few seconds and go, oh, share, right? If you share an article, people go, oh, can't be bothered. So I found what happens nowadays is people write articles and they just write dot points, and then, like, the text underneath the dot points, people just sort of skim through it. You know, that kind of stuff. But what then happens is you miss out on the core. You miss out on the actual meaning. Because by saying that you just have to rely on your common sense, you just have to rely on your logic, what happens? Is our common sense always common sense? Is our logic always right? How many times did you think something was right and you were so sure you could bet $100 on it, and later on you find out it's not true? Okay, throughout our whole day, we pick up various misconceptions of what happens, right? Two people experience the same event. They can come back and write totally two different things. Witnesses in cases, that's what they do, right? They're so sure it was a black man, and it wasn't. Or that it was someone dressed in blue, and it wasn't. But they're so sure, okay? So relying on a common sense, would that work? Okay, so where did this misconception come about? Where did this quote come about? Oh, before I do that, there is something I would like all of you to take away with you today, if you don't remember anything else. There's lots of stuff that you will read online. There's lots of free publication books outside, and they're all great. They're all really good resources. But don't take the commentaries of what the Buddha said as what the Buddha said. Don't just focus on what people say the Buddha has said, right? You need to go back and you need to read what the Buddha actually said. Doesn't that make sense? Straight from the horse's mouth? Go back to the earliest accounts that you can find of what the Buddha taught. Because as you find, as you read through different literature, you'll start to see there's some dissimilarities, right? Some things that don't make much sense, right? What do? You go back to what the Buddha said. And how do you find out what the Buddha actually said? There are things called suttas or scriptures, okay? They're direct accounts passed down from generations over generations of what the Buddha said, and that's the closest thing that we have to what the historical Buddha has told us. And you can access them all online. So see those gadgets on your table? You can go on there right now if you have access to the internet, and you can just read all of the suttas. So I can commend to you a few websites. Actually, I'll just commend one. This is pretty good. Start here. So it's the Pali Canon that I'm talking about, okay? There's different traditions. I won't go through that, but let's just use this one for now. Access www.accesstoinsight.org. So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw on the suttas. I'm going to go back to what the earliest accounts of the Buddha's sayings. And the website that I have used is Access to Insight. So you can also find the translations there as well. Okay? And of course, the Buddha didn't speak English, for those who thought that he may. And he wasn't Chinese, believe it or not. Okay? He was actually born in Nepal, or India, at that time. And the language that he used was Pali. Okay? So when I use some Pali words today, that's why. Okay, because sometimes it's actually really hard to translate certain Pali terms into English. There's always going to be something that's missed out. So sometimes I do use the Pali words for you to really understand what it's about. Okay, so two things, suttas and Pali. We got that? Great, okay. So where did this fake quote come from? Actually, it's not completely fake. It is sort of like a misinterpretation of this particular sutta. It came from the Kalama Sutta. I can tell you, I hate it when I'm sitting in lectures and lecturers put slabs of text on it. I get that. I totally do. Okay, so I'm not going to do that. I'm really putting it up there in a way so I can make reference to it and I remember what the sutta says. And secondly, also, so when you read the suttas later on, which I'm sure all of you will, you can all reference it back to here. Okay. So this is the Kalama Suttas. And the story goes like this. There's a bunch of Kalamas, these people who live in a town. There's two versions to it. One version is they're all a bit not quite there, you know, very confused kind of people. And so when they see the Buddha, they ask him, the Buddha, so how do we know whether or not something is true and accurate and all of that. Okay, there's another version of it, which is actually the Kalamas were highly intelligent people. Okay? All right, I know. How many people thought that? No, most people only hear the first part of the story. Actually, they were highly intelligent people, and the question that they posed to the Buddha was almost like a trick question. And the reason is this, because in this place, lots of people, lots of different teachers who proclaim that they know the truth will come and say something to the Kalamas. And the Kalamas indeed did get confused, right? All these different people talking to them. But their confusion isn't because they're low in IQ, but precisely because they're trying to test to see who actually knows their stuff. So we start this way. So suttas often start in this way most of the time. I have heard on one occasion, the Blessed One refers to the Buddha. Buddha was wandering through and the Kalamas went to the Blessed One. And then there's a whole slab of text about what happens, right? And very easily you would just scan over this and just move on. Actually, there's a good reason why it's in there. Some of them comes up to him and bows and sits aside. Other people, they have a good chat to him. Other people, they put their palm over their hearts. And others, some of them sat to one side in silence. So they just came in, didn't even acknowledge him and sat to one side. The reason why this is in here is because it's to show the audience that the people who came, the Kalamas who came to speak to the Buddha, there was a whole range, a whole spectrum. Some people really respected him. Some people didn't know him from the next person, okay? That's the kind of Kalamas that we're talking about. So how did the Buddha speak to them and ultimately convince them? And I should also say in India at that time, the context is there was a lot of philosophies around, there was a lot of people around, different people, different gurus, different schools of thoughts. And so the Buddha was only one of them, right? So he sort of had to stand out a bit. Yeah, no, I'm not going to read through all that, it's okay. So here's the question, here's a million-dollar question. They say to him, Lord, there are Brahmins and contemplatives who come to Kesaputta. They expound and glorify their own doctrines, but as for the doctrines of others, they deprecate them, revile them, show contempt for them, and disparage them. And then other Brahmins, blah, 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 etc., etc. They leave us absolutely uncertain and in doubt. Which of these venerable Brahmins and contemplatives are speaking the truth, and which ones are lying? So, they ask the Buddha, there's people who come here and they tell us that they've got it, right? They glorify their own teachings. And then there are other people who come to us and say, oh, don't listen to everyone else, right? So they either put other people down or they glorify their own teachings. So if the Buddha answered this question by saying, oh, don't listen to any of them, what happens? Isn't he just one of the others? Now, if the Buddha then replied, he doesn't want to reply to all the other ones, but he simply says, oh, let me teach you about my one, because mine is the truth, isn't he also falling into the trap of doing what everyone else is doing? So what can the Buddha do? He can't talk badly of others, right, or distinguish his from the others, and he also can't just simply talk about his own teachings. So the Buddha finds a really good way to do it. First of all, he acknowledges the Kalamas' uncertainty. He says, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, now this is where the quote comes from. Now tell me whether this quote is the same or different to the one you read before. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scriptures, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. Okay? Usually the quote stops there, doesn't it? Is that the same as what we read before? What's different about it? Okay, let's read the one before. Your own reason and common sense. He says, by logical conjecture, by analogies, by agreement. So he basically says, don't even use logic in all of this. Don't use thoughts in all of this. And he says, obviously, as usual, don't just follow traditions, legends and reports, okay? And don't just go off based on, oh, this teacher, we have to follow him because he's my teacher. So in a nutshell, that's what he's saying. And what does he say? He says, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And the qualities that he was talking about, which I sort of skipped over, is the defilements. Okay? So when you know that something is not good, when you know that something is unskillful and is going to lead to an unskillful result, then naturally, you naturally would know that because you have observed that it is unskillful. Okay? So I've highlighted it so you don't have to read the whole thing. So we've got greed, aversion, delusion. Okay, so what do you think, Kalamas? Are these qualities skillful or unskillful? Unskillful, Lord. Blameworthy or blah, blah, blah. Okay, so greed, aversion, delusion. If you know that there is greed and it's going to lead to an unfortunate result, do you still do it? So you look for yourself. You investigate for yourself. If you do something that is unwholesome, what is the effect? Unwholesome results. So next time, do you do it again? You won't. That makes sense. But it doesn't make sense because of logic. If I told you that, logically, you would find a lot of ways out of that. But it's only when you actually observe it, that's when it becomes real for you. That's when it makes sense. Okay? Is everyone with me at the moment before I move on? Yeah? So how does faith come into all of this? So on the one hand, we don't just have blind faith. We don't just follow a teacher. We don't just listen to what someone says. So a lot of teachers like to stand up here and give you a Dharma talk and then say, oh, but don't believe me. Go and test it out for yourself. Okay? That kind of idea. Right? So on the one hand, you don't have blind faith. But on the other hand, you must have some faith to push you along, to start you on the path. And I'll show you more suttas about that too. Because the fact that you were here in this room, if this is your first time coming here, you probably have to have a little bit of faith. You have to have a little bit of an interest, at least to be open enough to come. Okay? And that's just coming into this room. And then the next step is, okay, after you come into this room, you listen to what I have to say. And you think, maybe I'll give it a go, right? At that point in time, you actually don't know whether or not what I'm saying actually makes sense, right? But then it's when you give it a go and then you start observing the results that you realise, oh, maybe there is something to this. And I'll expand on this a bit more as well. There's a sutta that we talk about. Okay. So next time you find that on the internet, that quote, you can go, ah, that's not true. And you can link people back here if they start sharing all over Facebook. So then we talk about satta. That's the Pali word for faith, conviction, confidence. A confidence in the Buddha that gives one the willingness to put his teachings, the Dharma, into practice. So the Dharma is, that's Sanskrit, double M is Pali. And it's essentially the truth, the teachings. And you're like, hang on, it's talking about putting faith in the Buddha, faith in the teacher. But you just told me not to put faith in a teacher, right? It's a bit different. You're not following the Buddha because he's the Buddha. And that's a bit weird. But it's true. Right? The Buddha never said, follow me because I'm the Buddha, because I'm enlightened. But nonetheless, we'd need to start with that first step of having some faith in the Buddha as an awakened one. Okay? So the Buddha, the story goes, he reached nibbana, he reached enlightenment. And that's another thing that we don't talk about much nowadays, unfortunately, enlightenment. Because there's a lot of confusion about it. You can have momentary enlightenment, so I'm told, which means moment-to-moment enlightenment. So I can be enlightened one moment and then not be enlightened another moment. So there's a lot of confusion about that, and that's for another talk. But do we have faith that we ourselves will be enlightened? That we and what enlightenment means is to be free from the defilements of greed, hatred and delusion. That one day we can be free from suffering? I hope the answer is yes. I really do. Because that's why you're here. Okay? Not only to practice Buddhism to make this life more peaceful, more joyous, but actually to get right to the root of this existence, to uproot all suffering. Okay? Don't settle for second best. That's what you're here for. That's the point of the practice. So what the Buddha does is the Buddha has done that. The Buddha had that awakening and reached that enlightenment. And then he says that we can do the same. Now, in a way, you have to have faith that that's going to happen, don't you? You have to have faith that the Buddha actually was enlightened. But how do you do that? How do you get from here to over here with the enlightenment? So here I'm going to share my story. So for a long time I went through the whole, you know, it's all about common sense, it's all about logic. And I went down that path, right? So on the one hand I started with lots of belief, lots of faith kind of stuff. And then I felt, no, that's not the right kind of faith. That's not what we're talking about. Then I went to the whole, you know, don't have to have faith, just have to understand the teachings. And so for a very long time I had faith in the teachings, in the sense that I put it in practice and I saw what the result was. I have to admit, I didn't have much faith in the Buddha. He was the teacher and I respected him for being the teacher, but not necessarily faith in him. Okay? See the distinction? But I came from the point of view in terms of the teachings. But as so it happens, the teachings worked for me, right? It actually, when I put it into practice, I can see the direct result. And you can reflect on yourself. Why do you keep practicing? Why do you keep learning about Buddhism? It must be working for you. It must be. And so how I see it, it's almost like I get to one point and then for me to cross to the next point, I have to have that leap of faith. I have to take that one step further. I don't know where that step's going to take me. I don't know what the vehicle is. But that's the bridge. The faith becomes the bridge. And I'm coming from a very practical perspective. Okay, this is how it's happened to me. And then over time, I started reading more of the suttas, which I'm very thankful for that someone actually introduced it to me. Because instead of just reading about the commentaries of what the Buddha taught, I started reading what he actually said and how skillful he was as a teacher. And I started to learn more about the Buddha, right? And then that's when the faith arose in terms of the Buddha. And that's when my faith arose in his enlightenment. And from there, the faith arose to my own awakening, the possibility of it. Now, I'm not sure whether you'll take that same path, but I'm sharing that with you because that's what happened to me. And that's also what helped me greatly with my own practice. In terms of my own meditation, for example, very often you'll sit in meditation and you really don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to come up. And that element of faith is what's going to help you through. For you to sit and be open to whatever experience arises. And in a way, I can't really explain it, but that's how I experience faith in my meditation. And when I have that, I stop trying to control the process. I stop trying to hold on to what the outcome could possibly be. And just to open up to whatever arises. Okay? And so when I saw this online, and this came from Access to Insight, I was looking for a really good definition of satta. And initially, I was going to edit a bit. I was going to write a confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you know, the triple gem, the usual formulation. And then I thought, no, actually, hang on. There's a reason why he wrote that. There's a reason why it's a confidence in the Buddha. Because now when I look back, it's the confidence in the Buddha's enlightenment, that's why we respect him, his enlightenment, that then that gives us the right intention to practice for our own enlightenment. Because it's the confidence in the Buddha that gives us that willingness to practice what he taught for our own enlightenment. So very early on, remember how I was talking to you about meditation and the goal of your meditation? It's not just to have an okay mind, to have an okay life or a good life. It's more than that, yeah? And so we have satta, which sometimes is translated as faith, sometimes conviction, sometimes confidence, but it's all the same thing, okay? Any questions so far? Because I'm going to move on. Yes, I know. I've got another sutta. So this sutta, I won't give you the background, but essentially there is this this student. He's called Kabadika, and he was with some other Brahmins at that time. And the Buddha came in and he was having a discussion with them, and he had a particular question. And Kabadika in this is great. Like, he just keeps drilling the Buddha with questions. Like, if you read the sutta, you'll know what I mean. The Buddha will give one answer, and Kabadika will say, well, what about that? You know, it gets really into the details of stuff, which is great, because what he then does is he actually maps out a whole list of things in relation to faith that we can come to. Okay. So the first thing he talks about is conviction, which is faith, satta. So he says, well, if you have satta, how does that safeguard the truth? All right, truth meaning satcha. How do you know that this is the truth and you can actually safeguard it? And the answer, so the Buddha says, well, in order for you to safeguard the truth, what you need is you need to have conviction, you need to have faith. And then when you have that faith, that conviction, you'll be able to hold on and know that this is the truth and you can hold on to it. It's like to protect it, essentially. So likewise, if you have something that is valuable to you, this is how you would want to protect it. And then over here, the Buddha talks about all these things. Right, the unbroken tradition, something reasoned through analogy, has something to agree with, has pondered views. Does that sound a bit familiar? Does that sound a bit familiar? Yeah? Where did we read that?
Just then.
Yeah, just then. What, like just then?
like previous.
Yeah, the previous sutta. Yeah, the Kalama Sutta. This is another really good thing about the suttas. You start realizing they actually gel. They make sense. They overlap, right? There's some consistency in the Buddha's teachings. And here's the consistency, right? Right, so the first question is, how do you safeguard the truth? The second question, and that's the answer is with conviction. The second question is, to what extent does one awaken to the truth? And I've summarised it here, but the Buddha's answer is, well, you have to observe your teacher with regard to three mental qualities, qualities based on greed, qualities based on aversion, qualities based on delusion. Okay? He's not saying, oh, if you've got a really greedy teacher, you've got thing. He's saying, in the next paragraph, when I'm observing that the monk is purified with regard to these qualities, that's what he's talking about. So you know how just now we were talking about the Buddha being a teacher? And in the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha's saying, don't just listen to what the teacher says. Yeah? Have to figure it out in a way by yourself. But at the same time, we have to have faith in the Buddha. How does that work? This is the answer. It's not just a matter of having faith in the Buddha, as in this, okay? It's actually, here the Buddha says, after for a period of time that you've observed this teacher, if this teacher exhibits that he's purified from greed, so he doesn't want anything from you, he doesn't need anything from you, right? If you've observed that for a period of time, surely what he says would make sense. And then the next step is, if you've observed this teacher to be purified from aversion, right? So from dislike, from anger, from frustration, surely what he says must be correct. And then finally, the Buddha says, after observing a monk, if he's purified with regard to qualities based on delusion, that's when, at that moment, That's when you place your conviction in him. Not before that. It's at that time. So if you want to find a good teacher, sometimes people say, how do I know I've got a really good teacher? The Buddha actually said you need to observe your teacher for a period of time, which could be years actually, and you need to test it out against these three. Someone who's free from greed, someone who's free from aversion, someone who's purified their mind away from delusion, false views. That's how you know. And the accounts of the Buddha is that he was able to do that, hence he was enlightened. And if that's the case, that's how we put our faith in him. And then it goes on, and I'll go through that, but this formulation you'll see in the next slide. So you've got the conviction, he visits him, he grows close to him, growing close to him, he lends an ear. Lending an ear, he hears the Dharma. Hearing the Dharma, he remembers it. Remembering it, he penetrates the meaning of the Dharmas. I shall do it in this slide instead of the other one. So think about it for yourself in terms of how you came about understanding the teachings. You must have had some faith first. You must have had some conviction. Even if it's not full, but some sort of inkling. This could work, right? I'm going to give this a go. And because of this conviction, you visit him, visit the teacher. Here you can say it's not just teachers, but you can say books, websites, Udibuds, all of those. You come close. And then you grow close to the teachings. You grow close to your teacher. And growing close to him, you lend an ear. You start to listen. You start to really pay attention. And as you lend an ear, you hear the Dharma. It's interesting that there is a distinction here. Sometimes when we come to talks, we listen to the words. Sometimes when you read a book, you may read the words. You may get the message. But the Dharma, it's actually at a totally different level. So this is what it's talking about. You lend an ear, you fully hear it, and then you'll hear the Dharma. And hearing the Dharma, we remember it, so you take it away from you. Back in the Buddha's days, they didn't have technology to allow them to just scribble everything down. So nowadays when you sit in lectures, for example, how much of it do you really remember? Okay, that's why everyone is madly scribbling away notes or maybe typing on their laptop nowadays, because we don't train our memory the way we used to. And even before, like I used to make a lot of notes in Dharma talks or, you know, when I read stuff and I write them all down. But I noticed that when I'm writing or when I'm doing that, it's a totally different feel to if I'm just totally present with what the speaker is saying. And I get away and I leave the room with a lot more than if I had just scribbled down notes. So you can try that in your next lecture, actually. Okay? Try not writing any notes. You can write it afterwards, but just be fully present in that moment. And then you remember it. And then why do you need to remember it? Because when you remember something, you're actually internalizing it. You're actually bringing it in. If you just write it on a piece of paper, it's still external to you. When you remember something, you internalize it, you remember it. And, like the breath, you can then take it anywhere you need to. At any point in time, you can draw on the Dharma. It's there. And then as you remember it, what happens? You penetrate the meaning of the Dharmas. You get deeper into understanding it. And as you penetrate the meaning, you come to an agreement through pondering these Dharmas. Your worldview meshes in with the right view. Because you know what? I hate to break it to you, but as a society, what we're learning about, how we live our lives, is so contrary to the teachings. It really is. You know, on the one hand, we are taught to be competitive. We are taught to be the best of the best. We are taught to strive, right? To get those HDs, correct? How do you get HDs? You get HDs because someone else got a D. You get HDs because someone else got a fail. Yeah? If everyone did really well, you won't get high distinction. Okay? You only have that differentiation because someone's not doing so well. So it's embedded in our system about competition. Okay? Also this need of wanting more and more and more. Have you noticed? Financial security. That's what people keep talking about nowadays. You want to have some financial security. You want to have some security in your life, material security. Have some insurances. That's right. So why is that? It's because that is how we're trained, to think that we can actually protect our wealth. We can protect ourselves. And yet, here we are in society trying to get more and more and more. And what is the Buddhist thought? What does the Buddha teach us? He's teaching us to let go. Yeah? He's teaching us the more you hold on to in terms of craving and grasping and attachment, the more suffering there is. That's a bit different, isn't it? So how does that work? So the society's view and the world view is very different. So the world view and the Dharma view is very different. The Buddha also talks about generosity. So here we are wanting to keep everything for ourselves or our family or our immediate friends. And the teachings of the Buddha is to be generous and to not discriminate. That's pretty outrageous, isn't it? Okay. But it makes sense. Because what it then does, as you put this into practice, you actually break down a lot of walls that we used to put up because of that sense of selfishness. Okay? So, what we're just talking about now is exactly that. To accord our dharma, okay? To really make an agreement with our life with it so there isn't that so much of that conflict. Oh, it's back up. Can you see it? You sure? Okay. And then, once there is agreement through pondering those dharmas, desire arises. Now, desire here isn't craving. Okay? The desire here is the desire to... It's sort of like a spiritual desire. Okay? It's a different element. There's no craving to it. There's no sense of, oh, I know, I figured out the truth. Okay? There's no selfishness to that. And then with the rising of desire, he becomes willing. Willing, he contemplates. Contemplating, he makes an exertion. So exertion here, that's really important too. It's about effort, making that effort. Exerting himself, he both realizes the ultimate meaning of the truth with this body and sees by penetrating it with discernment. To this extent, there is an awakening to the truth. Now, that's quite a lot of stuff, isn't it? Yeah. Now, this is just the first stage. This is just about awakening to the truth. The sutta then goes on and talks about the other stages. So what do you do when you awaken to the truth? But just stop there. How does all this start? It starts with faith. Yeah? It all starts with faith. And so next time when someone says to you, oh, there's no faith in Buddhism, you can say to them, no, that is actually what starts the path. And that is what will continue you on this path. Because actually the path doesn't finish here. The path continues. Right? So that was just about awakening to the truth. This is now talking about attaining the truth. So how do you attain the truth? You attain it through the cultivation, development and pursuit of those very same qualities, purification of greed, aversion and delusion. And what will be the qualities that's most helpful for the final attainment of the truth? And then the Buddha lists out all of these things, which is what we just talked about. And the last one is conviction. So it's like a cycle. You start off with a little bit of faith, and then you do a little bit of work, and then you look behind you and you say, wow, there's so much results. So then you have a little bit more faith, and then you take another step and you do a bit more work, and you look behind you and go, wow, look how far I've come. This is great. And that gives you more faith. And with that faith, you take that extra effort. And with that extra effort, you look behind you and you go, wow, look how far I've come. That's the faith we're talking about. So it's a balance. Right? So I was reading Bhikkhu Tunisro's explanation of faith, of satta. He's an excellent monk and I commend him to you. And he talks about that. The first slide that I showed you in terms of blind faith, that is one extreme. The other extreme is where you say, no, there is no faith at all. It's all just based on logic or empiricalism. That's the other extreme. But what we need here is actually a balance of the two. It's where you have both, and they sit very comfortably together because you have faith to start you off, and that faith grows more and more. But how does that faith grow? It's because you've put the practice, you've put the teachings in practice, and you've seen the results. That's actually how it works. That's how it generates. And that faith pushes you forward. On and on and on. Until you get to somewhere where right now we may think maybe a bit of a mystery, but one day I really hope that we, each of us, will get there as well. And that is to the full liberation, to the full enlightenment, so that we can escape all of this suffering that comes from greed, hatred, and delusion. Thank you, that's my talk. Any questions? Oh, wait, that's not my talk. I've got another sutta. Would you like to talk about another sutta? Yeah? Okay. Oh, that was such a nice ending. Anyway. Not about this sutta. But I should remember this sutta because this sutta talks about the treasures, okay, the seven treasures. And the Buddha talks about all these things that would help us. And the very first treasure that he talks about is conviction. And then he talks about virtue, conscience, concern, listening, generosity, and discernment. And he goes through and he explains each one. And I find this so helpful. But certainly for conviction, he says, there is a case where a disciple of the noble ones has conviction, is convinced of the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, his awakening. Indeed, the blessed one is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those people fit to be tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings, awakened, blessed. This is called the treasure of conviction. Now the Buddha does. Now the sutta doesn't talk about having faith in other things, right? So sometimes I read articles that talk about faith, and they say, of course you need faith. You know, you need faith in the worldly sense too. So some say you have to have faith in the laws of the roads, right? That everyone is going to drive on the right side of the road. And I think when I read those arguments, I think actually they're sort of missing the point, right? They're taking it a bit too literally in terms of what faith is. Faith here is very specific. It's in the spiritual sense. And again, the scriptures come up over and over again. It's actually faith in the Buddha. And it's not in him as a person. So there isn't this divine being that's up there that says, good, meditation, I'm going to give you something. Okay, it's not about that. It's about his awakening. That's the most important thing that he can inspire us on in terms of our practice. And this is the same, right? It talks about his awakening, doesn't it? Yeah? He's convinced of the Buddha's awakening. Yeah? So that's the faith. So that's the first treasure. I'm just going to quickly go through the other treasures because they're really nice. Look, it's worth it, I promise you. Okay, so then we've got virtue, okay, which is, okay, here's brownie points. What's this one about? Does that sound familiar?
Five precepts.
Yeah, the five precepts. It's a treasure to be able to abide by the five precepts. It's an honour to be able to do that and live a good life, to live a skillful life and one of virtue. And the next one is the treasure of conscience, okay? So having that you feel a bit of shame if you do anything that has bodily misconduct, verbal conduct and mental conduct. Now, this is different to guilt, okay? We're not talking about guilt. I think guilt is quite a useless emotion because it's all about what happened in the past, right? Shame is about, oh, that wasn't very skillful, won't do it again. That's important because that teaches us not to do it again, yeah? Okay, the next is about concern, right? Having concern for the sufferings that result from bodily misconduct, etc., etc. So it's an appreciation of cause and effect. You do something that is a misconduct and you know that there would be negative consequences that will come from it, which then stops you from doing it, preferably. And then there is the treasure of listening, right? And again, it comes back to when you've heard something, you retain it, you store it. It becomes a part of you, right? It's something that you can take along with you. Then there is the treasure of generosity, and the ability to be cleansed of the strain of stinginess. I love that, okay? The stain of stinginess, because it's true, isn't it? You know, if you're a bit stingy, it just follows you, yeah? It becomes a habit. Living at home, freely generous. I love the living at home, though. I reckon the Buddha knew that rent prices was going to go up and, like, more people are going to stay at home. Right? So living at home, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in being monogamous. Is that like having one partner? Okay. Responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of alms. Okay, this is a treasure of generosity. And then we've got the treasure of discernment, which is the last one. And, of course, this is key in all of this. So this is a case where there is the discernment of arising and passing away. What's that about? Arising and passing away. What's the Buddhist terminology?
Impermanence.
Yes! Woohoo! And triple points if you know the Pali word for it. Oh, starts with A.
Anicca.
Anicca, of course. Okay? So the discernment of anicca. The arising and passing away. And just on that, I can tell you, the contemplation of impermanence is extremely powerful. Extremely powerful. If you want to let go of something, you contemplate on impermanence and you will let it go. Like really contemplate on impermanence, not just like half-heartedly. So for example, if you really feel like ice cream, right? Chocolate ice cream, Messina chocolate ice cream in particular, right? And you're in class and you really, really, really want it, okay? So much craving, oh, so much suffering, right? What do? You contemplate on impermanence. You contemplate on anicca, passing, rising, okay? Because it is that. You know, you can even, like, just look at the melting ice cream and just be turned off by it completely, okay? It works. It really does. And if you practice that often, then later on when it comes to the bigger things that you have to let go of, you already know skillfully what you need to do. So it starts off with the Messina ice cream, and then we can move on to, what, Lindt chocolate? I don't know. I don't know what the hierarchy is nowadays. Anyway, and then as we go on, it's the discernment of leading to the right ending of stress. Stress here is dukkha or suffering. So the right so all of that leads you to liberation from suffering. Okay, that's great. These are the treasures. And why I included that sutta just now was because I wanted to show that faith actually crops up in a lot of suttas. It crops up in a lot of these things. So you've got the treasures. I don't want to get too technical, but even in terms of the different stages of meditation, right, it comes up as well. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, this is what the Buddha said. Now, this is actually his quote. It's not just something that's made up. Wide opened is the door of the deathless to all those who have ears to hear. Let them send forth faith or satta to meet it. The door is there for you. The opportunity is there. You just need to send forward your faith and let that guide your path. And let that lead the way. Okay, that's my second cool ending for the night. I don't have any more slides, but I am welcoming any questions anyone may have.
Could you expand on the term deathless?
Sure. What do you think it means? I can't know, I'll give it to you. So the Buddha talked about, actually I'll introduce it. Okay, so we have something called rebirth. Why I was hesitant to introduce it is because nowadays there's a lot of talk about rebirth as well. People don't really like to talk about it, especially when there is the rise of secular Buddhists, which is a movement where they don't really emphasise on faith and they don't emphasise on rebirth. In fact, some actually say rebirth isn't important to the practice because we can't actually know for certain whether or not rebirth exists. Okay? I personally have issues with that because very clearly in the suttas the Buddha talks about the suffering that arises from birth, after birth, after birth. He talks about rebirth. Okay? He talks about times when we look at how much suffering we've actually endured through all of the lifetimes. He talks about his own ability to look at the past lifetimes. So I think it's actually there in the suttas. And so what the Buddha taught in terms of rebirth is that when we pass away, we come back again. Maybe in the human realm, maybe in the different realms. But the idea is each time you were born, you then go through a massive suffering. Because when you're born, what comes from it? You get sick, right? You get old, and you pass away. And so suffering comes with it. And then what happens is you pass away and you come back and you do it all over again. And you come back and you do it all over again. So the Buddha is saying, what if there is a way where you can end all of the suffering, where you don't have to come back again and again and again? And so this is what deathless refers to, where you don't have death, where there isn't that whole rebirth over and over and over again.
You just described blind faith, though. Mm. Just looking at the sutras and saying, he said that, therefore it must be true.
Mm. How?
I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of rebirth.
Oh, there is actually. Yeah, there is.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of evidence. I mean,
there's actually lots, volumes and volumes of research of the people who've gone and interviewed particularly children, and especially under the age of five, that's when they still remember their previous lives, and they actually account for all the things that they can remember in different parts of the world.
Yeah, this is Ian Stevenson's work, isn't it?
Yeah, there's others. There's others as well, though.
Okay.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying. And I personally don't particularly need that kind of scientific evidence for my purposes. My purposes is this. If you really understand karma, you understand how there is causation and there is effect. Correct? There is a cause and there is an effect. You can see that in this lifetime, in this very lifetime, right now, cause and effect, cause and effect. And that effect becomes a cause for the next effect. and that continues on. And if you consider that, and that goes through your entire life, what happens at the moment of your death? Does that just end there? Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is, we are all born with different conditions, right? Unequal conditions. Very young children already have personalities that are very unique to them, that is different to their home environment. So you can't just say it's all upbringing. What's the explanation for that? By the way, you don't have to believe in rebirth today, okay? Okay. This is just my personal view in terms of rebirth. I can also tell you from the secular Buddhist perspective, what they say is you don't really need to understand rebirth in order to practice. And I think there is some validity to that too, because what they're saying is if you practice for this moment, you are already getting the benefits of the practice. Okay? So that's why I started this by saying this is my personal view in terms of rebirth, because I appreciate that that's not shared by the whole Buddhist community. But in terms of when I look through the suttas, the Buddha talks fairly carefully and, you know, very openly about rebirth. And some people say, oh, that's because back then in India, everyone believed in rebirth. He was just using the terminology of the time. That's not true. At that time, rebirth was something that was still debated about. And there's a really good article, if you're interested in the subject, from Bhikkhu Tanisro, what's it called? Anyway, it's on Access to Insight. You can look it up. A really good article on rebirth and the different arguments that's come up in relation to that, and he also draws on the suttas to explain how the Buddha definitely talked about that. But that's also what I'm talking about, that leap of faith, just that little bit, because we don't really know for sure. And interesting enough, we at the moment there's a lot of discussion about rebirth and whether or not that's something that's real. But I think something that's even harder but more important for us to consider is whether Nibbana is real, right? If you think about it, in terms of rebirth, you can actually appreciate that here and now, in terms of causation. But yeah, like, no one's really questioned that. Okay. Hi.
Just a question that most... And with regards to what agnostics like to think about religion, which was in terms of Buddhism, what do you think? Where do you think Buddhism draws discerns between knowledge and belief?
Knowledge and belief. Sorry, I don't follow your question.
Because the philosophy is that knowledge of knowing something is different from belief, which is two different train of thoughts. Does Buddhism follow on to that, or discern between those two, or do they...
Okay. With belief, do you mean faith?
Yes.
Do you mean satta, or is it different?
I guess that could be another question. Is that interchangeably used? I don't get into semantics. So.
I've actually read some articles which talk, I think, sort of what you're talking about. I did really want to introduce other religions, but I'm just telling you what the research, what the thoughts are out there, and they essentially say that one of the main reasons why faith has been questioned in Western society is because a lot of people in the West, they want to break away from the thinking of the Catholic and Christian ways. So they actually find a lot of popularity with Buddhism, because Buddhism, you don't have to believe in a god. You don't have to just have that blind kind of faith, right, where you're not allowed to question something. Because in Buddhism, certainly the Buddha actually asks you to question things, investigate for yourself. Okay? So there has been this split between science and religion in the West. That's been a historical thing. And then based on that, there has then been this dichotomy between faith and logic, right? But what I hope that this talk shows is actually neither of them are useful, to be honest, because if both of them are taken to the extreme, you actually need a middle ground in between them. You need enough faith to push you along. Logic itself is not going to take you far enough, especially in meditation, when one of the things you start looking about is your thoughts. You start looking at your thoughts and realizing that actually you can't believe in your thoughts, you can't believe in your common sense, you can't believe in your logic. So that falls away. Okay? And of course, no, the Buddha never taught people to have just blind faith, where you just follow without questioning, for sure. So those two extremes, the Buddha would not, as you saw from the suttas today, that's not something that he would have taught. Does that answer your question?
Partially, yes.
Okay.
So would you say for Buddhists, when they read a text, is following considered as, do they say, like, taken as a knowledge claim or a faith claim in the sense that, what the Buddha said.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know this versus I have faith in this.
I know what you mean now.
Oh, yeah.
Some schools actually believe that the suttas themselves have power. So just by chanting it, there is some power that comes from that. There is also some schools that... Anyway, there's lots of these examples. But you saw from the text today, right, it's fairly clear that Buddha actually gave you a structure as to how to follow it, right? You first have to hear it, understand it, make it accord with your view, put it into practice. Okay, there is quite a structure to it. And there's also other suttas that talk about when you read the suttas, what you should do, right? So when you hear the teachings, you first hear it and it becomes an intellectual thing. So at the moment, we've got an intellectual understanding of faith. But that's just the superficial surface. That's just the first surface. It's an important part because you need to first understand it, right? The next part is you need to put it into practice. And then after you've put it into practice, you need to reflect on that practice and how that's actually helped you. So cause and effect, causality. And then it's only when you actually put it into practice and you say, oh, that actually worked, the faith arises from it. So you know how I was talking about faith being circular? You start off with a bit of faith, you do a bit of the stuff, you realise, oh, this is actually working, and that generates more faith. So it keeps going in the cycle. So there's actually stages to it. So you can't simply say, when you read something, it's knowledge or it's faith. The answer to that is, well, it depends on which tradition. And the second answer is, it's a process. It's not just simply you read it and you get it. You have to understand it here, not just here. Okay? Now, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Partially.
Faith is a precedence for knowledge, I guess.
Faith starts you by opening that book. That knowledge then is put into practice, which hopefully generates more faith for you to open more books. How's that?
Sorry, just as a comment also, I like what you mentioned, and the way I see it is also faith in a sort of Judeo-Christian sense doesn't take you very far, because if I read a recipe book and I have faith that I'm a good cook because I've memorized the recipe, it doesn't prove anything until you put it into practice. So maybe through pondering views, you look at, oh, somebody's followed this recipe book. They've got good results. They're a good cook. So by inference, you can see, just by observation, just like in the sutta, it is only when you actually take the time out to follow the recipe, get the ingredients cut it up as per instructions, and you see the fruit of the practice, the result of the recipe, and you taste it, then you get verified that, you know, oh, this is actually a good recipe. Yeah, I'm actually a good cook because I've tasted the results. So in that sense, having faith or belief, just because you've memorized the recipe, doesn't help you too much, because the Dhamma is very practical. And it's only when you put it into practice that you get the results.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for that. Any other questions, comments, complaints?
Yeah. Earlier you said that instead of using faith, you use the word confidence.
Yeah.
But maybe that makes more sense when you use confidence.
Yeah.
Because faith, I mean, I've brought up in the Christian
I get that. Yeah, I mean, I know. And that's why I put up the other variations. And the other one is conviction, you know, so you're very certain about something. That kind of stuff. So yeah, any whatever works. That's why use the Pali Satta. Go back to basics. Yeah, but I hear what you say. That's why. But I think we also use faith because we do want to challenge that kind of thinking too. But you're right. Some people do bring in that baggage in a way from other religions. Yeah.
So just a random question. How do you contemplate on the impermanence? Like, what are the techniques out there?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that phone, for example, that you're holding, what's it made up of?
Rare earth elements.
That's right. Okay, so one way to do it is disintegration. Right? So the breaking up of it. Exactly. How easy is that? If you just go, oh, it's just plastic, you just put it down. Right? So that's one. The other one is by seeing decay, right? So the body, for example, will decay. I've actually got white hairs that I deliberately don't pluck out so I can remind myself of decay, right? So that phone, for example, what is it? What phone is that?
Samsung.
Samsung S4?
It's Note 1.
Note 1, okay. So when Samsung Note 2 comes out, okay, if it has it already come out or not?
Yes.
Okay, well, when Samsung Note 48 comes out, okay, what will that phone be?
Nothing.
Yeah, chuck it away now. No, but that's not the point. Actually, the point of impermanence is, oh, and by the way, the Buddha didn't just say, just be poor, just give it all away and live on Centrelink or something, okay? First of all, there was no Centrelink in India, but also the idea is understanding that you can have something but not be attached to it, believe it or not. Yeah? It's like one of those lines I was talking about in the beginning, you know, with control and completely being unmindful, and we were talking about the middle path, there is that line that you can actually have as well, where you can have something. Things can be useful to you, but you're not attached to it. And you're very content and you're very happy. Right? And you understand that it's impermanent. So when it actually leaves one day, there is no sorrow, because you knew it was going to happen anyway. So, for example, Ajahn Chah, he's great with analogies. He looks at a cup and he says, this is broken already. Yeah? So what I was saying before, you disintegrate, you consider decay, and then you see impermanence. So when this cup breaks, he's like, well, it's just going back to its nature. That's just how it is.
And it applies for, say, for example, sometimes when you have sort of a very physical emotion that arises from you, from, you know, craving like the chocolate ice cream that you have. So the same techniques applies, you know, just think of it at something that can force apart at the end of the day. So.
Exactly. I mean, an ice cream, really, how long does a pleasure last for?
Years.
Years? That one ice cream. It's probably decayed by then. You're talking about multiple ice creams, though, aren't you? Yeah. One tub does not last for a year, even if you stick it in the fridge. Please don't eat it after that. Okay? But it's that experience is so fleeting, and that's the point. All right?
Well, you need a bit of wisdom, though. I mean, not everyone.
Definitely. Yeah.
I've heard that there's a technique that you can incorporate a bit of sort of that impermanent contemplation in your meditation as well.
Definitely.
Like, what is that? Do you know anything about it?
Well, just now when you're contemplating on your breath, uh-huh. when you're looking at the rising and falling of your abdomen, mm-hmm. that's to lead you to certain truths. That's to lead you to see certain things. Yeah. So in meditation, for sure, you will see impermanence. That's the point of it. When you look at your breath, does it ever come in and exit the same way? Your breath is so unique. We just think our breath is the same because we're so used to lumping everything in as if it's just one solid entity. Yeah? But actually your breath is different all the time. Your mind is different all the time. The mind that you came in with is different to the mind that you have now. And now. And now. Yeah, I know. Buddhism can blow your mind. It really can, okay? So when you start looking at that, and how you do that is you train your mind, right, through meditation. So your mind becomes very clear, very sharp in its observations, and you can see these moments of arising and passing away so quickly. And your body is arising and passing away as we speak. You'll see it. Yeah, let's keep practicing. Other questions? It doesn't have to be about faith. It could be anything. It is the first talk. Oh, wait, it's past time.
Yeah,
we're having
like
so much
fun.
I'd like
to stay for questions.
I'm just going to...
Oh, okay. All right. Any other questions? Okay. Well, I hope you all enjoy this semester as we skate towards the end of the year, and I hope you all enjoy it. And UniBuzz is actually a really good resource for you to learn the Dharma. And when I look back at the times I had the 3 months holidays, do you guys still have 3 months holidays?
Yes.
I have to admit, I look back and I think, oh, what a waste. I should have had like a 3 month meditation retreat back then. Because now that I'm working, to find 3 months to go on holidays to do a retreat is near impossible. Especially having my own business too. Right? So, 3 months holidays. Do something worthwhile.